We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
From the Mobile Pod World headquarters, this is the Carolina Insider from Learfield.
Game yeah. For the Tar Heels, Jones.
Talk about that one. We have a really cool interview today. And just as a side note, we got a lot of really good interviews coming up. A lot of them. We could run just shows of nothing but interviews, and you'd be happy. Because
a lot of people are sitting there going, yes!
Yeah, please. But so we've got a bunch of good interviews coming up here over the next several weeks. But today you're going to hear, we talked about a little bit late last week, when we were down in Atlanta for Carolina against Georgia Tech, stopped at Clark Atlanta, Division II school down there where George Lynch, former member of the Tar Heels, of course, 1993 national champion, George Lynch is the head coach, and had a chance not just to sit down with George, but had Eric Montrose with us as well. And so Big Grits and George and Adam and myself were all there, and a little bit of a longer discussion, but just really talked about a lot of fun things. And you know, Eric and George kind of got going, particularly in the last half of the interview. So I think you're going to really enjoy it when we get to that in a little bit.
What would 1993 Jones have said if I would have told him that one day, sir, you will just sit down with Eric and George and talk Tar Heels yeah. and Coach Smith?
My surfer cut. I had like the short on the side, long on top. I'd been ready. I'd have been fired up about it. I had my black shoes on, been ready to go.
I would have put on my best turtleneck for that occasion.
Where's my billabong? But Adam, let's start with this past week, and we have a bunch of other mess I'm sure that we'll talk about, and we have story time, so we have a lot of good stuff coming up. But Adam, let's start with Saturday. I thought it was Carolina's. This is going to be different. What I'm about to say, I didn't think it was their best game as far as Carolina playing its best. Or their best performance, but I thought it was their most impressive performance, if those two things make sense. I mean, I still think Carolina against Virginia Tech, to me, was the best I've seen the Tar Heels play, because it was defense, it was offense, they were doing everything right. This particular game, Carolina didn't shoot the ball extraordinarily well. Kobe White struggled from the field, one of the rare times that he's had just a really tough night shooting the ball. But Carolina won this game by playing really good defense, maybe their best defensive effort of the year. You know, getting out and taking advantage of Louisville turnovers. It felt like every turnover Louisville had turned into a bucket for Carolina on the other end. Dominating the glass, making free throws at the end, you know, hitting some key shots when Louisville would make a push. So it was just all of it was just all of that. It wasn't just because Carolina shot well. I thought they did all the other stuff to win this game, and that was impressive.
I thought the defense was really encouraging. And I think the concern earlier in the season had been, well, maybe they're just not that good defensively. Maybe they're just not good enough defenders, and they're just not capable of defending at a high level. But now I think we've seen maybe they can play a little defense, and I think that's promising. And so was the effort on the glass. I mean, it was like Carolina decided Louisville was just not going to get any rebounds. They would not allow it, and they didn't get a single offensive rebound in the first half. And it was team-wide. It was everybody. Yeah. It wasn't like one guy got 19 rebounds. It was everybody had 5 to 10. Of course, Luke May and Cam Johnson both with double-doubles. But just a really solid effort performance.
I thought also, you know, there have been some games in Virginia Tech. We talked about this, how exciting it was. The freshmen were such a big deal and how Carolina won that game. This game, Adam, it was kind of the old heads who made it happen for the Tar Heels. Luke May with 20 and 11. Cameron Johnson, again, with just a very efficient, high-quality game, 19 and 10. Kenny Williams had 10 points, but he had a huge three-pointer in the second half and some big shots. And Garrison Brooks, who is not a senior but a sophomore who's played a bunch, as we've talked about. You know, Garrison, I thought, had one of his best games. 12 points, finished strong in the paint a couple of times. So some of those – it was more the experienced guys in this particular game who led the Tar Heels to a win, and I think that just speaks again to the fact that Carolina does have a pretty balanced attack there where they have a lot of different guys who can be effective.
And I think it's encouraging that Louisville has a lot of the things that normally would make Carolina concerned. Got a couple of pretty good big guys. They'll turn you over. They'll make you foul them and put them on the free throw line, and Carolina didn't really do that. And Carolina took care of the ball. I mean, we only really talk about it when they don't. And certainly we can think of a couple times on Saturday when they didn't take care of the ball. But overall, I think 10 turnovers total in the game. That's very manageable for this team.
Also, got some good contributions from the bench. And it was important because, you know, no Leaky Black, no Sterling Manley, some foul trouble early. Cameron Johnson had 2 fouls in the first half. Garrison Brooks had 2 fouls in the first half. And Carolina was able to get some quality performances from Seventh Woods, had 4 assists, no turnovers. Nasir Little didn't score a ton, but was really active on the glass, had 6 rebounds. Brandon Robinson came in and kind of did what he does and make some good passes and get some key rebounds and just be active. And Brandon Huffman came in and gave the Heels a few good minutes, and so just got some positive things from varying levels, varying degrees from those guys coming off the bench.
I thought the key was just what you said, was that everybody kind of did what they do. They didn't try to do more than what they can do. Seventh Woods played good defense and distributed the ball and then took it to the basket hard one time. Brandon Huffman was just kind of big, and he knocked a couple entry passes away, and then his one basket, he just all of a sudden decided that he was 7 foot, 200 and some pounds. He's going to the rim.
Yeah.
And that looked really good. So I think everybody's kind of figuring out their role and how to best do that and not trying to do things that aren't in that job description.
Again, you don't, and I think we probably cautioned this after the Louisville loss. You never want to get too high or too low after a bad performance or a great performance, because it is such a long season. But just an encouraging win for Carolina on the road again, and in the way that the Tar Heels did it was more impressive to me than the fact that they won the game. It was how they won the game, which was so impressive.
And Louisville's a tough place to play.
Yeah, it can be, yes.
I think they put a lot of people in there. There's a lot of things to do around the arena for you before you go into the game.
Yeah.
So you can get fired up if you want to. So it's loud. They were honoring Muhammad Ali, who's an important person in the world, but also in the city of Louisville. So I thought, all intangibles considered, that was a really good win.
Anything else from that before we get to tonight?
No.
Okay, so now Carolina hosts NC State. And, Adam, it's almost as though, you know, I would almost say, oh, the Tar Heels have to be careful because, I mean, State had this incredibly poor offensive performance on Saturday where they scored just 24 points. I mean, just a mind-blowingly low number. Carolina's coming off a quality win and has won 5 in a row. And so I think you could go, oh, this is trap game here for the Heels, got to be ready. But I think it's almost so extreme and who the opponent is. I'm not saying Carolina's going to win the game. I mean, I'm not saying, oh, the Tar Heels definitely going to win. I would be very surprised if they didn't have – if this game didn't have Carolina's full attention, I guess is my point.
I think if State had lost like 50-48 or something, then it's more of a trap game, because then you kind of think to yourself, oh, they're not very good. When you're the worst there's been by any ranked team in the shot clock era, everyone is capable of understanding that was an aberration. That is not something they're going to repeat, because no one in basketball has done that. But I do think you – I mean, they'll be a little guarding against it, but I think the benefit here is Roy Williams is not going to let anyone look past NC State. I don't care if they don't even have full team. If Kevin Keats is going to play point guard and David Thompson and or Ernie Myers is going to be the small forward, then he's still – he will have them frothing by Tuesday tonight around 7:55, I would think. I would be very surprised if not.
Of course, the Tar Heels won the first meeting of the season over in Raleigh, and what was a competitive game, Carolina stretched it out the second half of the second half and had a advantage, but it was still close until the final couple of minutes, but was a very competitive game. And so, and remember, Carolina got off that a really good start in that game too, where they were up 12-0 or 14-2 or something like that. It should be an energetic night in the Smith Center this evening, I'm sure.
Remember State won in Chapel Hill last year. A lot of current Tar Heels remember that, I think. So I would expect a good effort.
Yeah, Braxton Beverly, you know, coming off a really poor shooting performance. He was 0 of 12, I think, against Virginia Tech. Markel Johnson did not play a lot. I think that's the right thing. Or I didn't play much or didn't play well in the
he
game.
He definitely didn't play well.
Yeah, against Virginia Tech. And so, you know, that's a dangerous backcourt combination. Beverly played very well against Carolina the first time these two teams played. So it's going to be a competitive game. It's Carolina State, and Tar Heels will be ready. Wolfpack will be ready, and I'm sure it'll be a good ball game.
And the Pack's got so many different pieces. They can – you may see someone tonight who you don't remember from the game in
Raleigh.
That's
a good point.
Because they have used all kinds of different arrangements and rotations. Remember, Funderburk was really good for a stretch, so Carolina's going to have to be strong in the paint. I'd expect to see more of him tonight.
That's something actually that we didn't talk about from the Louisville game. You know, remember, Enoch in particular, but Malik Williams and Enoch in the first game in the Smith Center dominated that game. I mean, lots of Louisville players played well, but I thought Enoch in particular was a difference maker in that game. Had 17 and 11. The points are career high for him from that first game. There was not much at all. I don't think Enoch scored in this second game, and Malik Williams was 4 of 10 from the field. And so to have that turnaround, you were talking about the defensive effort, and I think a lot of times when we think about defense, you think about guys guarding the ball on the perimeter. But what Carolina did in the post was pretty impressive too, and that was, you mentioned Brandon Huffman, that was Garrison Brooks, that was Luke May, that was sometimes it was Nasir Little or somebody else. I mean, what the Heels did against those bigger players in the post I thought was impressive.
There was a stretch in the first half where Carolina went smaller, and so Luke May had to guard Enoch. And that's an assignment he has sometimes struggled with, and you kind of thought, this might be where Louisville really concentrates on getting it inside. And Luke May just wouldn't let him get the ball. It was some of the best post defense that Luke has played certainly this season and maybe since he's been here. And if Carolina can keep getting that kind of effort down low defensively, obviously they have a chance to be pretty good.
Before we get to our interview, let's get to our UNC Healthcare Know Your Stats feature brought to you by UNC Healthcare and MyUNC Chart. Keep track of your stats with MyUNC Chart. Visit the website myuncchart.org to sign up. And Adam, this win for Carolina, the Louisville game, their fifth road win in conference, five road wins for Carolina, has guaranteed them that winning record on the road. Under Coach Williams, that means that the Tar Heels have now had a winning record for the eighth time in the last 9 years on the road and the 12th time in his 16 years as Carolina's head coach. That is an impressive stat, to have a winning record in conference on the road eight times out of the last nine, and 12 out of 16 in total is pretty good.
And Matthew McDonald had sent us a question about that. So, Matthew McDonald, you can now know your stats.
Yeah, that's right. And you can visit myunchart.org. All right, let's get to our conversation. Again, this happened in Atlanta. This was the Tuesday that the Tar Heels played. So last week when Carolina played Georgia Tech, sat down in the gym. We were in the gym in Clark, Atlanta. Adam, me, Big Grits, George Lynch. I think you'll enjoy it.
This is a very special episode of the Carolina Insider.
Seventh grade Jones would be so excited right now to know that he's doing this interview with these two guys.
Ninth grade Adam has actually chased these guys around some hotels trying to get autographs. He's camped outside of the Smith Center waiting for them, and they've kind of peeked out and gone, that annoying kid's out there. Let's go the other way. And I finally chased him down. We're with Eric Montross, who, of course, listeners to the pod know as Big Grits.
Yep.
And George Lynch, who, as we know, was the senior captain of the 1993 championship team. Really looking forward to getting to talk to these guys. Thank you both for giving us some time.
Thanks for having me. And, I mean, George even allowed us to come after big-time win against Morehouse.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. It was great. Great atmosphere. Guys played hard. Coach Scott had a great evaluation of Morehouse. So the scout was perfect, and the guys finished the game very well.
George, before we replay every play of the 1993 season, which we're going to do, catch people who don't know up on what you've been doing and what you're doing right now.
The last maybe 8-9 years, I've been pursuing trying to be a coach, college coach, NBA coach. I spent 5 years with Coach Brown at SMU, and then I went to the G League. I had an opportunity to work in the G League for the Detroit Pistons. And at the same time I was, you know, assistant coach with Larry Brown, I was doing the assistant coaches program for the NBA. And that's kind of a leeway to help guys get into coaching. So I worked a few NBA camps. And then this opportunity came up here at Clark, Atlanta. Darrell Walker was the previous NBA player who was coaching here at Clark. And last year, in this summer, he took the job at Little Rock, Arkansas. He's from Arkansas. And so he went back home for that opportunity. And then I was able to fill in.
George, what are some of the unique challenges maybe of a job like Clark Atlanta compared to some other places that you've been previously?
The finances. We don't have a big budget. You know, part of my responsibility is to raise funds for 3 scholarships. So I'm trying to raise money so that we have 10 full scholarships on the team. You know, we don't have a weight room. We don't have the meal plan where we go to the Angus Barn before every game. So, you know, I'm working. We're doing the best we can with what we have. We got a great group of guys, all doing well in the classroom. They're working hard. They're trying to learn the Carolina way. And it's going good for us right now.
What have you learned about your coaching style, kind of being thrown into it? What are some things that you've thought, I'd always like to try that maybe you've gotten to try and they either have worked or have not worked?
You know, the difference between D1 players and D2 players, majority of the guys going to be more athletic. Some could have a higher basketball IQ. And then, like you said, most D1 players you're going to get can play several positions. At this level, you might have 1 or 2 guys on the team can play more than one position. And majority of the players, your big man is probably 6'6", 6'7". So you're not going to get a 7-footer. I'm lucky enough to have a 6'10 freshman on the team now. He's redshirting from Dominican Republic. But throughout the league, I mean, it's going to be a bunch of guys around 5'10 to 6'4". If you got to play against a team that's 6'6", that's a big man.
George, I would think that there would be, having played with you and watched how you move around the court and what you see, and I know this isn't your first coaching gig, but I would think there's some limitations for you on what you can expect out of your players, because you might see it and you might think, well, that was second nature.
Right.
Is it hard as a coach to see something in a situation and not have a player be able to do it? or have those expectations?
Well, it's you know, I reflect a lot back, you know, our days playing for Coach Smith, how hard it was as a freshman to know the system. A lot of times, well, for me as a freshman, I didn't really understand the system until February. Everything was still moving fast. I was a good enough athlete to get by with it, but it didn't slow down for me until February. Now, as a coach, and then the players you're playing with, you're playing with 7-footer Eric Montrose, who can keep the ball up over his head and dunk it. Then you're playing with, you know, Brian Reese and Derek Phelps and Donna Williams can shoot the lights out of the ball. And then you go to the NBA, and then you got guys 6'7", 6'8", can do things that point guards can do. And then you come back and coach at a D1 level, you know, at SMU. And so I was almost – the route I took, I went to the highest level and I came back down. And then and as I was coming back down coaching in the G League, there's a reason the guys are in the G League not playing at the NBA level, because they're lacking something. So I was almost prepared for it. But when you're coaching – like I'm coaching to win a championship. I'm coaching these guys like Coach Smith, Coach Brown, Coach me when I was a player. And Melvin and I, you know, we know the Carolina system. We want to put Carolina sets in. I've picked up some things from Larry Brown and Tim Jankovic at SMU and also coaching in the G League. You want to put those sets in, but you can't because these guys won't pick it up as fast. So we have to stay within their athleticism, their basketball IQ, and make the best of it. And Melvin and I bumped our heads together on the bench. He didn't see that play, or why did he make that play? So it's a little bit of chess going on that, you know, okay, he's about to make an easy play. So I'm standing up yelling. And I try to, you know, I reflect back when Coach Smith was coaching, he was so calm. He sat on the bench and he told me one time, he said, "I don't yell at players during the game, because if I didn't teach you in practice, then I understand why you made that mistake. Now, if you out there make a mistake and I keep you out there, it is my job to take you out." So Melvin and I have done a good job of pulling guys out when we think, because they don't. We're trying to get them to give the tie signal. They still haven't figured that out.
Look, man, it's hard to turn down men.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then I have four guys, really three seniors and one junior, playing almost 40 minutes a game.
Wow.
So our practices are like NBA practices, where only the guys who have limited minutes get all the practice. I try to rest my starters because they're playing close to 40 minutes, and I gave them 2 days off. So we're trying to do the best we can with what we have.
Before we get to 93 and just your Carolina time, you mentioned in an earlier answer that one thing you're trying to teach these guys is the Carolina way. What does that mean to you? Is that strictly on the court that you mean that, or is that a bigger picture kind of thing when you say
No,
that?
It's a bigger picture. You know, we try to keep the students on campus involved, so we make sure that our students on the basketball team are very respectful in the classroom, even walking on campus, you know, carry themselves as, you know, as gentlemen. We try to recruit guys with high character so that there's, you know, you're in Atlanta. There's a lot of temptations in Atlanta. So we're trying to make sure that these guys are going to represent the university well, which is what Coach Smith wanted us to do. And then at the same time, make sure we put a good product on the floor so that the student population comes to the games. Our game Saturday was a sellout, standing room only. It was kind of like the Duke Carolina rivalry, so it was great. So that's we try to make sure that the guys do their community service. You know, when they walking around the community, you know, they're gentlemen and representatives of the university.
All right, Eric, you were a year behind George. Do you remember first meeting George? Do you remember what were your initial impressions of that meeting?
I remember seeing a guy that as a freshman was playing more than any freshman had played in many years for Coach Smith, because that was really hard. I mean, George alluded to it, but he came in and it wasn't just – he may not have picked it up fully by February, but he was playing a lot early, and that was something unique. You knew that I probably don't remember the first time. Maybe it was probably in Granville when I moved in, coming down to school, and then walking down to play pickup that very day and realizing – everybody out there, and particularly him, they were different because they were really, really good. So, but the thing about George, that I tell people this all the time, he was probably the best on-court teammate that I've ever been around, just because I felt like, now don't blow this, because this is okay.
Thank you. I slipped him a 20 before.
I know who paid for the Chick-fil-A now.
But I think we had a really good connection just offensively and defensively. The connection was that I just reacted to everything that he did. But, you know, I think that there was we had a mutual respect that we knew that at that time, you know, it was still – there was a difference between the 4 and the 5 player and the 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. You were going up against guys that were bigger and stronger than anybody else on the court. So we really – we were the ones that could switch to each other's men.
Yeah.
And so there had to be a real trust and reliable. So in game was great. In practice, you know, George was awesome in the game, just regardless, but also in practice, he set the bar very high for us.
Sure.
Because of the things he could do. And therefore the expectations for all of us were to match a lot of that. And so we were pushed by that, but then also even in, you know, I remember, when Harley Dart was running us through preseason conditioning.
Yeah.
You know, none of us liked it, but all of us did it because we were pushing each other. And and that was the thing. I never saw George cut a corner. And that's the thing that I think was most impressive about this guy, was that he was just a workhorse.
Well, and George, Eric was part of a fairly touted recruiting class. Do you remember the first time you saw the guy with the flat top coming in, and that he was supposed to be this big guy who had been on the cover of some magazines and
or
stuff?
Or do you remember the first shot that I took that Pete Chilcutt blistered right back in my face? That highly touted recruit got crushed.
It was great that recruiting class that came in. Because the year before, we knew that we were going to lose Rick Fox, we're going to lose King Rice, Pete Chilcutt. So it was basically Hubert Davis, myself, and, Henrik Roto. And then when those guys came in with that recruiting class, it was, you know, we wanted to win a championship. Duke had just won 2, and we was like, look, man, we got to do something about this. So, you know, leading up to that, you know, they even had Cliff Rozier, prayers go out to his family, you know, he's died at an early age. But that recruiting class, it brought some energy, excitement to the campus. You know, they were the original 5'5". You know.
Which one were you, Eric?
I was definitely the 5th out of that 5.
So it was great. They got to play that 1 year. We went to the Final Four in Indianapolis. Came up short, but we knew we had a great group. Guys, like Eric said, we came to practice. We competed every day in practice, and it paid off for us.
What was it about losing in 91 that helped you win in 93? Was there any correlation in either one of y'all's minds about those two things, about coming so close 1 year and then getting back a couple years later?
For me, the one thing I remember from that team, the three seniors shot 5 for 25.
Yep.
And my meeting with Coach Smith after the Final Four, you know, he relied on the seniors back then. And, you know, I was coming up. I was going to be – I, you know, would have been a senior the fall 2 years later, you know. And the conversation we had was, you know, we had talented, you know, freshmen and sophomores that following year. And then myself as a junior, I was a sophomore, my sophomore year. And he said that he relied a little bit too much on his seniors. You know, going into the 93 year, I wanted to make sure that I did everything I was supposed to do. You know, my freshman, sophomore year, we didn't really have a real running program. And
it felt like it.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like it, but, you know, the seniors got to choose whether we had a running program or conditioning program. And
You got to choose if you did have one?
The seniors did.
Why would you ever choose to have one?
Well, I mean, if you want to win a championship, you got to have one. So,
you mean if you're a finely tuned athlete. Yeah, okay, yeah. I got it.
So, like Eric said, everybody hated that run, Laurel Hill run. Now I look back on it, I was like, what were we thinking about? But me as a senior watching guys who could run long distance, like not the managers, but guys who were 12th, 13th, 14th man on the bench.
I mean, Matt Westrom.
Yeah.
Would win our mile.
Like guys like that beating us up the hill. I mean, I was like, I came in great shape. And looking at the heels of guys who didn't play at all, beat me up that hill. That was motivation. We earned the respect. You know, I was just telling my guys, because I'm trying to teach them to give the tie signal. I said in the championship game, we might have been down a few points. I came out. And I'm sure, I think Eric came out, they commentators there, Coach Smith pulled his starters. The trust we had in the last five guys was, now I look back on it, I would say that's unbelievable, because most guys now want to play every minute, whether they tired or not. We trusted in our bench players, our reserves, to go in and hold a lead or not give up a lead too many points. I think we sat for like 3 or 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and that carried us through the rest of the game. So just getting back to that point was, you know, 91 to 93, there was wins and losses throughout the year. That 93 year, we had lost to Michigan and Hawaii. We lost to Wake Forest. We lost to Georgia Tech. And I remember Derek Phelps saying, man, this is our last loss after the ACC tournament. So – although we lost four games, those games, we went on 10-game win streaks, you know, 8-game win streaks. But each loss gave us time to regroup and refocus. And that's, I think that was the difference between 91 and 93.
You mentioned, Eric, the Fab Five. And some people may or may not remember, you had to play Michigan, as you just mentioned, in Hawaii before you ever played them in New Orleans. What do you remember about that first matchup with them? What made them so good, and then what was that first game like in Hawaii?
Carolina will have Montross, Phelps, Lynch, Williams, and Reese on the floor. Weber with 27 points. He's hit his last five shots, 10 of 18 from the field, 5 of 6 at the line. 77-76, Michigan over Carolina, 25 seconds left. Reese will inbound right in front of the scorer's table. Looking, gets it in to Donald Williams. Shot clock is on. Donald Williams against Fife, midcourt area. Donald Williams now moving on the drive into the lane, stops, running one-handers up, and it's good! 12 seconds left, 78-77. Fife gets it to Juwan Howard. Howard down the right side. 5 seconds left. Howard in the corner to King. King to the baseline. Shots up. No good. They throw it up. It's good. It's good. Michigan wins. Michigan wins. Michigan appeared to be disorganized and sort of out of sync. The ball was just thrown up. And it was Jalen Rose. Jalen Rose who put in the game winner just as the clock was going to 0-0, and Michigan wins it. Michigan wins it.
The thing I remember about the first game, you know, they're obviously very highly touted coming in, but the thing I remember was the locker room after the game. Because I remember kind of just staring up against a chalkboard, like a whiteboard, and just thinking, I can't believe we just lost that game. Because we had high expectations, and we had worked in preseason, and that was an early Thanksgiving matchup. And obviously Michigan was good. I think the takeaway from that was that we were close, but we also knew that we had a long way to go to be as reliable and consistently good as we wanted to be. But I just remember that pitiful feeling in that locker room after the game, and I don't think that it was – feeling like individually that we were outdone. I just think we felt like, and I don't know, George, maybe you remember differently, but I just remember being up against that wall thinking, are you kidding me? Like, it was just a really somber, kind of realistic feeling that we had just failed. And it was early, and so that feeling of failure, I think that goes back to what George said. There was this attitude of anything less than success, there is no midway. There is no, we're going to get them tomorrow. It's, you failed.
Yeah, I remember going into each game, and even my freshman year, I remember this from the day. We played Oklahoma. We were number 16 seed, barely got in the tournament, playing against the number one seed. And Coach Smith drew up a play. And this happened throughout my entire 4 years. If I'm able to draw plays up like that as a coach, I'm going to be a Hall of Famer. But so he drew up a play, and he told each player what was going to happen, when they, whether they ball fake, made a pass. And man for man, offense to defense, he explained to each guy. He said, this is what you're going to do. This is how they're going to react. They reacted to it to a T. And after that, knowing that Coach Smith was on the sideline, I knew we had a chance to win every game. So when we played the Fab, whoever we played, Kentucky, the Fab Five, Kansas, we had Dean Smith and they didn't. That was my attitude.
George, there's a pretty famous, at least in Carolina basketball circles, photo of you and Eric, and you guys are walking and your arms kind of around them and you guys are talking to each other. And we've gotten – I've heard Eric's side of this story before. I'd be interested in your side of if you remember that photo and what was happening in that interaction.
You're talking about the Kansas game?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, like Eric said, anything better than your best was failure. So there was a play, I think one of their players was dribbling up the floor. Coach Smith used to always do this drill, hit it from behind to your teammate, you know, the steal. And, you know, at the time, you know, because he's 7 feet, we like, look, man, you 7 feet, but I seen you run like 6'6" guy or 6'7" guy.
Thank you, George.
I was about to say, I've never heard anybody say that.
I really appreciate that.
So
you talking about Eric Montrose?
So he, you know, he didn't give his effort of knocking the ball away. So, you know, this is Final Four. If we lose this game, we don't come back. So I had some words to say to him. I said, Eric, you know, I don't know how nice or how bad I was. But
Eric, my good friend, I'm not sure.
but Eric and I, we've been in the trenches together, you know, and he's taken blood and stitches for me, and I've done the same for him. So for me to go up to him and talk to him, however I said it, but he knew it was coming from a place that we wanted to win. And so it was just an opportunity. He didn't take advantage of it. And we put it behind us. We ended up pulling out of that game, and that's what it was about.
Eric, I was about to say, what, do you have the same recollection there?
Well, in all honesty, it's kind of interesting because I don't think we've ever talked about it,
no,
George.
No,
I mean, we've never talked about it. And both of us remember – the thing I remember so much about that, because I get it from people, they'll say – oh, look, you and George walking arm in arm, behind, you know, laced behind each other's backs in the championship. It's so great. And I sit there going, yeah, it was not great. But the thing I remember is that it was how the message was conveyed. It wasn't – I mean, George and I weren't going to yell and curse at one another. And get. It was just a doing what teammates do, which is reminding you that there's a certain amount that we settle for, and there's a lot that we don't settle for, and we're committed to play for one another. And so when you miss an opportunity, whether it's a defensive rotation or trying to flick the ball away or missing a play set, that you're letting the team down. And I think that that's part of being a good teammate, is being able to give yourselves checkpoints,
right?
And to being able to receive them well.
Yeah,
I don't know how I responded, but my guess was I was like, yep, you're right.
Yes, sir.
You know, sir, Mr. Lynch.
And a lot of the things that we went through as players, championship, what Melvin went through at Carolina, we try to instill in these guys. Because, I mean, if I can get my guys to talk like me and Eric would talk to each other or get on each other, and those guys to accept it well, we'll go to another level. So it's really not – basketball, what we're trying to teach the guys, it's the stuff that will go along with these guys when they leave here. And that's what Coach Smith instilled in us, and I'm sure Roy instilled it in Melvin. That's what's going to make these guys great, great people and great young men.
But don't you think it's about – really that can almost can be summed up as you put your teammates before yourself.
Exactly.
And yeah. that's hard, especially now. I mean, we're watching our guys on this year's current team, and I think they're really good, high-caliber young men. But I think that they've never – they've always thought of themselves as kind of the top of the food chain. They're the ones that have to make the difference. They have to be the difference makers. And when you come here and we've heard Nasir talk about it, you have to take a little bit of a step down and recognize that you don't know everything, and the game doesn't hinge on your ability to make a single shot. But it really is about just being supportive of one another as teammates.
One of my favorite games that year, before it even got into the postseason, was the Florida State game at the Smith Center. And you talked about, George, how Coach Smith was so good at kind of orchestrating everything on the sideline. But Florida State was good that year. I think people now may not realize how good they were, but they were good. They were a little bit mouthy maybe. And had Carolina down big in the second half at home. What's y'all's recollection of how you kind of made that comeback against them?
You summed it up. I could just see Sam Cassell talking trash. Sam Cassell was still talking trash when we got to the NBA.
and throughout the NBA. Yeah, yeah. Didn't stop after year one in the league.
Exactly.
It was like nine years later.
So they were good. They were talented. I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. Now looking back at it, that, you know, these guys talking trash to us, they coming in our house, we wanted to beat them, and we wanted to play well. And Coach Smith was perfect, because when we was trying to make that comeback, he said, look, let's get this to 10, and I'm going to call a timeout. And he did it. Well, first, when we went to the locker room, he was like, there's a billion people in China that's not even watching y'all play. So we sitting there thinking about a billion people in China.
that was the magical halftime speech.
But it was 20-something thousand disappointed that we weren't playing our best game. And then we came out, he said, cut it to 10. And I think that might have been before halftime or whatever. But he said, it was after. He said, let's cut it to 10. I'm going to call a timeout. We cut it to 10. He called timeout. And he doesn't say anything to us, but he said, look down at their sideline. And we looked down, and they were all arguing with each other. Coaching staff was, didn't know what was going on. And then he said, all right, go back out there. And then – we made play after play. It settled us down. I hit a three that I hadn't shot in all year. And
I mean,
a couple
that took
guys,
some guts to take yeah, that shot,
you
big
know,
fella.
Exactly. A few guys.
I was
yeah. Hemrick got it going. Donald got it going. You know, the comfort thing was that Derek Phelps put so much pressure on the guards that we knew and – for some reason, Coach Smith was like, all right, if you see a trap, you can go. Or if you see a gamble, you can go.
Now, let me just – that's what he told you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I knew – I said, well, I got Eric back there. If anybody get by me, Eric is going to at least challenge him at the rim.
That's right.
So it was – when you got those layers of comfort, I had Derek Phelps pressuring the ball. And then I had Eric on the back row. And then between me and Brian, and we could – rotate and gamble, it made it easy. So, I got a lot of credit for getting those steals, but if it wasn't for him on the back row, it wasn't for, Derek applying the pressure and then Brian Reese able to play the lanes, it gave the other team something to think about. And they made a lot of careless passes, which, I took advantage of.
Pressure by the Tar Heels in the backcourt with 1:50 to go. Florida State is out of timeout. Sura hands it off to Ward. Right back, it comes, stolen by Lynch. Lynch will get the dunk, and Carolina leads. 78-77, the first time Carolina has led since it was 5-2.
So let me just clarify one thing.
Yeah.
Because this whole we take a lot of risk and let's just say – Coach Smith allowed George to take a lot of risk, and we all had to react.
That's right.
To whatever George wanted to do on the court.
Well,
a famous perspective.
He did tell me that, though. because it was funny, because we'll watch film, And a lot of times I weren't where I was supposed to be. So, you know, if you was Derek's man and Derek wasn't there, I was gone. So everybody else just had to. And so
we're
it
like,
would be times.
There he goes.
Yeah, now it would be times. It would be times that, you know, I was playing so aggressive defensively that, you know, if you know how to watch film, I would be out of position. But in Coach Smith's eyes, because I was able to cover, he allowed me to do it.
Eric, am I wrong in saying didn't the Weber timeout play, wasn't George freewheeling a little bit on that play, or am I totally wrong about that?
Yeah. I did freewheel. No, but, you know, we played them in Hawaii, and they didn't have a press offense. It was mind-boggling that Jalen Rose, who that best ball handler, would take the ball out of bounds every time.
Yeah.
So I said, Eric, you go back. Again, I'm freestyling because I knew I could get back to Juwan if they pushed the ball up the court. And then I knew I was quick enough to stay in front of Chris Weber. So I told Derek, I said, Derek, you play in front of Chris Weber, and I'll play behind. So when Jalen stepped back on the court, you can get back to Jalen. And then me and Eric could just switch when we get back down there. And that's all it was. It was just a two-man press, and it worked out for us.
Michigan out of timeout. And Weber, front court, Carolina thought he traveled with it. Weber, front court, Carolina with foul. He takes the timeout.
Technical
They're out
foul.
Of timeout. Technical foul. Technical foul on Michigan. They're out of timeout.
Do you have any – I mean,
and
I was
– Just let me interrupt for just a second. Like, that stuff on the fly, decision-making
– I was about to say, I can't imagine that's super easy to
no,
do.
I mean,
not everybody's out there doing that.
And I think the thing about it is that what he's saying, and obviously you got to have that basketball IQ to think about those scenarios presenting themselves.
Yeah.
But he also knew that his team was going to be able to react and that we had played together for, at that time, over, you know, three years.
Yeah.
And so everybody that was on the court was either playing together for 3 or 4 years, and we were playing a lot of minutes together. So we all knew how to play off of one another. And I think that's a lot of the magic that a lot of teams miss when they don't have that veteranship.
Right. And then Coach Smith would put us in game situations. Like he'd put 3 minutes on the clock, score 45, 54, and he'd give the lead to the role players. And he'd say, all right, y'all come back. So we practiced, and we did that a lot. You remember the time Donna called timeout?
Wait, hold on. We don't remember this. Somebody tell us.
I wasn't in practice that day.
Man, look, we in practice and we going over situational where he put us up 8 or up 10 or down 10 and we got to maintain the lead or push the lead or come back.
Sure.
So we making a comeback and like I said, everybody was McDonald's All-Americans, even the guys on the bench. And we trying to come back and practice where Coach Smith gave him 10 points. And then if you lose, you got to run. Remember, we
hated,
had a running program.
We hated to run.
We hated to run. This was suicides. This was three-hour practices. Now the guys, you go an hour and a half, they complaining. So we had to end the practice, and we making this comeback. I don't know how many we were down on the clock, but we get to, like, three within three. Donald dives for a loose ball. He comes up with it and calls a timeout. Man, you should have. Coach Smith, and he, like, blew a top. And he's like, those are my timeouts. Nobody used my timeouts but me. I mean, he made his point clear.
Some things never change in Carolina.
And then,
that's
and
good.
And then he put us on the end line, and I felt like we were running forever. So you know, that was a teaching moment. You know, and it came down to a national championship game where I knew nobody on our team was going to call a timeout. But, you know, because Michigan wasn't prepared in the press offense and they weren't, I'm sure they were told and taught on timeouts, and maybe they didn't practice it enough. They burned the timeout that they didn't have.
Speaking of guys who were hot and talking trash, was there any concern in y'all's mind that Nick Van Exel was going to score 125 points in the regional final before he ever cooled off? And when Brian went up to dunk the ball, take me through the sequence of thoughts in your minds.
Go ahead, Eddie. You got.
Well,
one of them.
I'll start from the last one because I remember that play that Brian, you know, again, it was like, that's what I thought of when you start talking about Coach on the sideline, you know, making these plays, and he'd say, George, this is what you're going to do, and here's how your defender is going to play you. Eric, this is what you're going to do and how your defender is going to play you. And the whole time, and it was right at the end of the game, you know, because we had just a number of – you probably remember how many seconds were on the clock, but it was just a couple. And it was – and the last thing he said, Brian, you're going to be wide open on the backside on this lob pass. When you catch it, you will have time to go up, but you will not have time to dunk it, so you have to put it off the glass. And
he made it clear.
He made it clear. I mean, he spelled it out. He had told us every detail, and everything came exactly the same way. I mean, the ball comes in, guys go in certain places, defense does exactly what Coach Smith says. Brian catches the ball wide open, goes up, and
and out of all the plays, Brian was probably the only one that could dunk it, you know, with the way they drew the play up, you know, a straight up off a vertical. And we looking at Brian, walking back to the timeout. We like, you.
Art McDonald on the spot. He reminds him. Gets it to Derek Phelps. Phelps high lob into Brian Reese. Down, up. Oh, he missed the dunk. He missed the dunk. He missed a dunk, and we go to overtime.
So no one was happier overtime went the way that it did than Brian Reese.
That's why we can tell that story and laugh about
it.
That's
what's hilarious now. It's
hilarious
now. And that's why Brian's still a friend.
Oh, Van Exel. I was about to go somewhere else. But
So I talked to Van Exel because we both went to the Lakers after that year. And I said, man, you was on fire. What happened? He said, man, I stayed up to 5 a.m. And I was like, I'm glad you did.
It's a good thing it wasn't 4:30.
And here I thought he was going to admit to Derek Phelps being his nemesis.
I mean, but Derek did play great defense on him because I think we switched Derek over on him.
At halftime. Yeah.
But he was on a tear. But he told me, he said, man, I stayed up too late. That's exactly what he said.
It'll bring you down every time.
Yeah, that's right. Thank God for our curfew.
You guys had, I guess it was just last year, right? The reunion, the 25-year reunion for that 93 championship. George, I'd just be interested in kind of what that event, kind of the memories that it brought back and what it was like for all you guys to get back together.
Like Eric said, it was a great time because majority of the guys on that team, we were there for 3 and 4 years. We went through the ups and downs. The losses, you know, at Cameron Indoor Stadium, the wins, and for we all came there to win championship, and for us to be able to accomplish that, I think it put us in a, you know, not a lot of guys, a lot of Lettermen come through Carolina, but a lot of them don't win an opportunity to win a championship. So it put us in a class that these, you know, we won in 93, the guys won it, you know, Melvin won a championship. It puts you in a class by yourself almost. And just knowing with the guys, Kevin Sabadori lives here in Atlanta. He comes to games. There's a bond that we have, you know, when we're able to get back together and winning that championship makes that bond a little tighter.
I remember Phil Ford would say, and it's, he's told this story a lot, but he said, I would trade my jersey being in the front row for a ring. He said, because that's how special it was. And I think that's right. I mean, as you were saying it, I was sitting here thinking the very same thing that, you know, it doesn't mean that we're better than anybody else in Letterman, but it does – you get such a level of respect for what the achievement is because we had so many good teams and so many great players at Carolina. And when you think about all the players, you think about just – how hard it is to get to that Final Four and then to win it. I mean, and we lost it once to Kansas and won it once against Michigan, but it's tough.
Yeah.
George, Eric was talking about your leadership, and Coach Ford always likes to talk about how he called you Mangani because you were a warrior. Where did you learn how to lead that way?
Well, when I was younger, my son's age, I used to go to the park, and I used to always come home and tell my dad, I'd be like, they not passing me because I was always playing with older guys. And when you play with older guys, they take all the shots and you just that fifth player on the team. And so he asked me, he said, can you dribble? I said, yes, sir. He said, can you rebound? I said, yes, sir. He said, can you play defense? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, play defense, get the rebound, and dribble the ball up the court and shoot it yourself. So I stopped coming home complaining. And, you know, that's how I learned. I was like, look, if I get this rebound. And then Coach Smith told us, he said, look, if you guys get an offensive rebound, I'm going to allow you to shoot it.
He did.
He told us that. So I was like, if you get more than 10 shots at Carolina, that's special. So Eric and I was down there. If we were able to go get more than 10 shots, five or six of them had to be offensive rebounds. So that was my motivation to get my shots and stay in and be able, because we had great players. I mean, like I said, I was the only senior on that team playing, and I was playing with four juniors who were had the same accolades I had coming out of high school. So in order for everybody to get their shine, I had to say, okay, I'm a work in the paint, I'm gonna get rebounds, and I'm gonna make a career out of it. And that's what I did.
Eric, I know we've asked you this before, but I'm interested in both of your opinions on this. Now that we're a couple years removed from Coach Smith and Coach Guthridge both passing away, when you think about those guys now, what do you think about the impact that they had for each one of you guys?
Gosh, yeah, I would appreciate a little bit of a heads up on that question, Jones. I think the impact is really felt so much for me beyond the court. I remember the humility that both of them handled themselves with. I mean, don't get me wrong, I remember some of the court stuff. I mean, I remember sitting in the office watching film with Coach Guthridge and him hitting play and watching me run down the court. And he said, Eric, are you running as fast as you possibly can back on defense? You know what I'm talking about, George.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, what are you going to say? I was not in the starting block running in the Olympics as fast as I possibly. No, sir. He wrote it back again. Eric, are you sure you're not running as fast as you can? Why are you not running as fast as you can? You know, there were those not so subtle moments, but I think just the respect that they treated us with, and I think a lot of that they recruited us because they knew that we were probably going to do a lot of what they asked us to do, and we were driven to be really good individually, but also as a team. But I just love the impact that they had on my life. I mean, when I think about so many of the good aspects of Coach Smith sending us to Children's Hospital in Cincinnati during the NCAAs, taking the time out of our schedule to do what we were supposed to do within the community. I remember when they had us dress, you know, coat and ties, which Coach Williams does a lot of that now as well. But I remember walking in, and this happened in Cincinnati as well. I think we were walking into the boathouse. Isn't that where we had ribs that night? And we walk in, and there were at least two other teams in there that were just in sweatpants and T-shirts. And we walked in coat and tie. And I remember Coach Smith or Coach Guthridge one saying on the bus afterwards, he said, you know, I got stopped by some of the other patrons in there and said just what an impression that made to have this team walk in like that. And Coach Smith would tell us, he said, we're gonna stay at really nice hotels. We're going to eat at really nice restaurants because that's what successful professionals can do. And you're going to act and look and treat each other like professionals. And I think that just made a huge impact on me. But, you know, Coach Guthridge, it was like the yin and the yang between those two. They were a great team. And I think that's there was humor, there was love, there was compassion, there was the mentoring aspect. It's really hard to define much more pointedly than that, but it was just such an overall impact.
George, how about you?
Since Eric touched off the court, I'll tell you one story that I experienced that I had with Coach Smith. It wasn't really basketball, but it was me doing what I was supposed to do. And so, you know, they have those autograph signings. Mm-hmm. And I swear the whole bowl of the Smith Center was full of stuff that we had to sign for
autograph. Yeah, they put them in the upper bowl.
Yeah.
They only let me send in 150 things.
I mean, I mean, so, and they have managers sitting there making sure that you sign every autograph. So I'm like, okay, Coach Smith told us anytime there's Coach Smith and Coach Gaffney, academics comes first. I mean, they would let you miss practice if it came to class. So I'm sitting there, and I had a test coming up, and I'm struggling in the class, so I know I got to be on time to this tutor. So he was also real stickler about being on time. Someone else's time, you got to be respectful of. So we just had a long practice. I don't know how long practice was, 2-3 hours, whatever. He didn't care. So I'm looking at all these autographs I got to sign, and I know I got to get to training table and get to my tutor before when I'm supposed to be there. So I'm sitting there, and I'm like, there's no way, you know, I'm going to be able to sign all these autographs. So I sign as many as I can, and I leave. Now, when Coach Smith calls you to his office, you know something is wrong. Because he doesn't bother us. He let us be ourselves. But when you walk into the basketball office and the secretary say, oh, Coach Smith want to see you. Now, I've been there 4 years, and he never said, I want to see you. So I'm like, okay. So I go in, and then he has a desk probably big as his gym, and he got paper stacked up. And you can only see his face. So I'm sitting there, and he don't say anything for a while. I guess he's trying to figure out how he's going to ask me. Now, I know for a fact when Coach Smith asks you the question, he already know the answer. So you don't – there's no line, you know. There's no way around it. So he asked me, he said, George, did you and this – now, I had conversations with Coach Smith since my freshman year where he makes me feel this small. And, you know, everybody think, oh, George, yeah, but to Coach Smith. So I'm sitting at his desk, and he said, did you sign all your autographs? And I'm thinking, I'm like, no, sir. And then he said, why? And I said, well, I had to meet with a tutor. And he said, so then he throws all the former players in your face that ever played for him. He said, well, I've never had this happen before, and I've been coaching for 30 years. And, you know, however many years it was at right. that time. So I'm sitting there, and I'm feeling smaller and smaller. I'm probably this big in my seat right now. And he said, Michael Jordan has signed every autograph, every autograph we've asked him to sign. And then I'm like, oh, you know, I'm like, he about ready to kick me out of school, take my scholarship. And so I'm sitting there, and he said, well, Michael Jordan has signed every autograph we asked him to sign. I said, yes, sir. And then he softened it up a little bit. He said, well, you know, just so you know, just from now on, make sure you get all your autographs signed. Man, I was sweating bullets at that time. By the time I left his office.
So, it was never a real comfortable moment sitting across never. That.
It was.
I knew we were going to see you today, George. So I pulled a couple pictures from key moments in your life that I'm 100% sure you will remember, and I just want to see what your recollections are. This is the first one.
Oh, that's me with Bill Clinton. Yeah. So that was a great moment, and part of an honor to be a senior. You know, Coach Smith would allow seniors to
do everything.
Yeah, do everything. So, and I took.
Yeah,
that,
I noticed Eric's not in that picture.
So I took that with great pride that he gave me an opportunity to stand up in front of the media and give President Clinton a Carolina jersey.
Now, I know you're going to remember this one, too, because it's probably just as big an impact on your life. That's me right there.
Oh.
That's outside the basketball office.
Man, that was back in the day. Look at that flat top.
Yeah. I think this is 91.
You could land a plane on that.
Yeah.
That is he talking about your flat top, Adam? No. I can't see the picture.
I don't know if he can see. I'm wearing a classy black turtleneck under my Just Do It Tar Heel sweatshirt because I was probably going to go out after and maybe do a little roller skating or something awesome. So I'm sure you remember signing the team poster right there.
Yeah, that was – I just had a meeting with the president here at Clark Atlanta, and I was explaining to her how the students and the fans, the Carolina fan, appreciate the players. And there's kind of a bond because there's there's a young lady here in Atlanta named Tracy Pennywell. She was she might have been a junior or a senior my freshman year, and we have a relationship. She never played sports. You know, I might have met her 3 or 4 times my freshman year, but now that she lives in Atlanta, she's helping me with the fundraising. She's been great, and a couple other Carolina folks, you know, Amy Edelstein. She was a junior my freshman year. She lived in Granville. They've welcomed me with open arms and made my transition to Atlanta, Melvin's transition to Atlanta, very, very easy. And I appreciate them helping. I appreciate just little things like that, Coach Smith making sure we sign as many autographs to the fans who's waiting out in the cold or rain for our signatures. So I really appreciate that. And that's a part of the Carolina way. And I'm trying to instill that in my guys to make sure that they don't turn down opportunities like that.
Guys, thank you both. Somebody, this is fun. Appreciate you guys giving us a few minutes and doing this. We had a good time. Thank
man,
you.
Man, we're sitting here and coaches and your head coach here at Clark, man. That's pretty cool. We're sitting in your gym.
Yeah. So it's my first head coaching opportunity. And, you know, Coach Scott is doing well as my assistant. And we're trying to win some games, and I think it's going to be great.
I heard one of your guys come out when we pulled up in the parking lot, and he looked at Melvin. And he said, "Coach, that's a tough workout, wasn't it?"
Oh yeah. Hey, the other thing here, Coach Scott and I do everything from admissions to workout to finding dorm rooms to we do it all. We do laundry. We take the practice uniforms back home. So it's a humbling experience, and we're grateful for the opportunity.
Whether your favorite seat is courtside or comes with a bird's eye view, head to StubHub. Grab 100% verified tickets. You know you'll get in. StubHub's the official fan-to-fan ticket marketplace of Carolina Athletics. And also Pinehurst Gilhance redesign of Pinehurst number 4 opened in September to rave reviews. Forbes magazine calls it one of the must plays in the country. Be among the first to play. Visit Pinehurst.com. Adam, that was a fun interview with George Lynch.
I could listen to them tell Dean Smith stories and 1993 stories all day.
I enjoyed the where he kind of, I remember that time where Donald did that timeout in prep. We were like, whoa, no, we don't tell us. So really appreciate George's time. And, of course, he mentioned Melvin Scott a couple of times during that conversation. Melvin, the assistant coach at Clark Atlanta. We talked to Melvin as well while we were there. And so you'll hear that interview coming up in the next couple of weeks as we kind of try to fit all our jigsaw puzzle pieces of interviews together here in the best possible way. So we, again, appreciate their time. And, you know, they're coming off a big win. They had practice, and so we appreciate them letting us have some time. Adam, I'm going to guess that you have a list.
I do have a list.
Let's visit.
What's on the top of Adam's list? Brought to you by Top of the Hill, where Tar Heels come to celebrate.
Several fun tweets on the list. I really enjoyed the tweet we got from Brett Hickman, who sent us what I assume is his son, Henry. Did you watch this one?
I did.
And Henry was standing in front of the TV during the Carolina-Louisville game, and Henry informed the Cardinals, "You got the smoke."
Hey, when Henry tells you that, it's a ball game.
Yeah. So, thank you, Brett. Also, we need to mention a big how can you justify that.
I do not have to justify.
How can you justify what you've done? How
can you justify sacrificing our love?
How can you possibly justify that?
To the Pinewood Derby in Chris Furr's hometown, wherever that might be.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I had forgotten about that tweet.
Chris Furr sent us pictures of, I guess his son perhaps is, Pinewood Derby car. Did you ever do Pinewood Derby?
No, but I know what it is.
I did, and I was bad at it. Right. That's not my thing. I'm not good at making things or writing or podcasts or anything like that.
Right, sure.
So I try to stay away from that.
You know, I'm just realizing this picture. I was imagining this thing being really big, but now I see like a pair of scissors and some duct tape next to it, and it's smaller than
it's like a little bigger than a Matchbox car,
yeah,
a Pinewood Derby car. So you make the car out of wood,
yeah,
and then you like shoot it down this ramp, and you have a race.
Yeah.
Like, you don't ride in the car because it's a little bigger than a Matchbox car.
Sure. Unless you're super tiny.
Right. And so Chris Furr sent us pictures of theirs, which was awesome because it's got some Argyle on there. It's got the Jumpman, big Tar Heel-themed Pinewood Derby car.
It is impressive artwork on here.
I deem it the first place winner.
Yeah.
However, this particular Pinewood Derby said that this car placed just third.
Chris is in Cary, according to his Twitter.
Come on, that's crib.
That's your hometown.
Yeah, gotta be better than that, Cary. You gotta be better.
Yeah.
I deem that first place Cary Pinewood Derby winner.
Yeah.
And I can justify that because I saw the pictures. So, Big, how can you justify that to crib for messing up the Pinewood Derby judging? Because that won't write. A lot of news in the Hallmark Christmas movie front.
Yeah,
over
really
the
was.
Last week or so.
It really was.
Jones, are you aware, Michael Cunningham sent us this tidbit, Hallmark Channel will be running a Christmas movie every Friday all year.
That's good to know, just to get yourself in the spirit.
I mean, you may not have time to do any more Roadhouse challenges because your Fridays are going to be busy. Also, they were filming a Hallmark Christmas movie in Charlotte, it looked like.
So that answers your question. I'm surprised they filmed them so quick. Remember you asked me when...
Yeah.
And we thought maybe the summer, but it does, I guess, I mean, it takes a whole year to get those masterpieces put together.
Yeah, that's tough to do.
Yeah.
And they were having a casting call in Connecticut for a Hallmark Christmas movie, but you were not able to go, I don't think.
No, unfortunately.
So you're not going to be in that one. We mentioned Matthew McDonald and his question about ACC road records. That is done. We need to give a big what up. UNC women's basketball.
Yeah.
The Tar Heels are putting it down these last couple weeks. Big win over the Wolfpack.
Four straight wins, all in conference. Two wins against top 10 teams in the last week or so, including that win against NC State on Sunday. State has suffered some injuries, but they were still the last undefeated team in women's basketball. And Carolina able to go over to Raleigh and get the big win. And so good to see, similar to the guys, that the women are seems like they're finding their footing at an even higher level now, and you hope that they continue to build on that.
Big what up to Sylvia Hatchell and
Stephanie
the
Watts, big game.
Yeah. Big news in the rap game, Jones. Two pieces of news. One, Lil Baby is coming to Raleigh.
By the way, I like how this has become like a recurring segment for you.
Yeah.
And my wife the other day was like, does Adam know when he talks about rap that he sounds like an old man?
Yes.
And I was like, yes, he does.
Yeah, that's
that.
The whole thing. So Lil Baby's coming to Raleigh in April.
Okay.
I feel as though it is absolutely necessary that Lil Baby needs to be on the pod. What I would ideally like to do, Jones, is have Leaky interview Lil Baby.
Well, get to work.
I plan to. I don't necessarily know the channels that you go through. Like, for example, to set up an interview with Leaky, I know how to do that.
Sure.
To set up an interview with Lil Baby, I'm not quite as familiar with that protocol.
Lil Baby, come join us in Mobile Pod World Headquarters.
Lil Baby, have you seen our palatial surroundings? Look, we started from the bottom, now we're here. But also, as you of course know, 21 Savage was number two on my list of rappers in the rap game today.
I actually saw this news this past weekend and was like, boy, Adam's going to be upset. I actually thought that.
Several people sent this link to us, which I appreciate. I think I've really reached a high pinnacle of the career that I'm the first one people think of when news when news breaks in the rap game.
Yeah.
Who do you tell? You tell Adam. 21 Savage may have been living illegally in the United States for about 10 years, got arrested by someone in our house, I won't say who, said, did you see that 21 Savage got arrested by ISIS? Like, that's a lot more serious. Like, you don't want to get arrested by ICE, but definitely not by ISIS. So not sure what's in the future for 21 Savage's career. That'll definitely juggle the rankings.
Yeah.
He was number two Everyone else slides up one. So, little baby, you're up to number two.
He's suspended for now.
Yeah.
Until this gets cleared up.
Yeah, but he's going to have to work his way back up. Like, somebody can come take your spot, 21 Savage. So we've had several people, as you would expect, request that we put together a playlist so that they can sound cool for their kids, just as cool as I sound.
I got to tell you, that's all on Adam.
Well, don't worry. I'm on this. I'm trying to Bradley Cox asked about it. Where can he get the playlist so his 16-year-old will think he's cool? Next pod, we'll have a playlist for you that'll help you. I'm going to tell you right now in no uncertain terms, it will not be clean in any form or fashion. Yeah. So you got to have the earmuffs on if you go to the Spotify playlist.
Yeah.
So next Friday, we'll break it down for you, and I'll try to have a new rap ranking because I feel like there need to be four. The final four. And with 21 Savage on the sidelines, we got to have somebody fill his role. Now, just as serious as that, sometimes we stumble on a legitimate news item on the list.
Yeah.
And this is one of those times. The Louisville Courier Journal wrote a story about University of Kentucky basketball attendance. Hmm. And the first sentence is, Big Blue Nation has a secession problem. And basically, it's about how attendance is down, and they're going to reduce Rupp Arena's capacity by 3,000 seats. And everyone thinks that is a good idea. They're not complaining about it. It turns out, though, that the problem is not selling the tickets. It's the people using the tickets. So the story says no-shows are on the rise. More than 28% of the tickets distributed this season have not been scanned at the arena.
Wow. That's
almost a third.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So that seemed high to me, so I did a little research.
No.
And we're not going to talk about specific numbers from here at Carolina, but I can tell you that the folks who know a lot about tickets said that number is not out of whack. Like, to me, that sounds really high. And it sounds like that number is not crazily high. So I think a lot of times we talk about, when you talk about attendance or whatever, well, first of all, number one, they're reducing capacity. Look, hashtag power of the pod. We've been on that train for a couple of years now. But number two, a lot of times when you talk about attendance, you talk about selling the tickets. It sounds like one of the big problems might be getting the people who bought the tickets to come to the game. And you know, like, all the tickets for the Duke game are going to get used. People are going to come. It's those early season games that are a little more tricky.
Knock your numbers down, yeah.
Right. And it's tough, I would imagine, if you're an athletic department because you've made the money on the tickets already. So it's tough to devote a lot of resources to how do we get those people to come.
Well, I think another is some of it's, I think, schedule too. Like this week for Carolina, I mean, you've got three home games in a row and they're all within 6 days. And that's good for Carolina to be at home. And of course, I mean, it's just how it broke down. But, you know, a Tuesday, Saturday, Monday is not necessarily easy for someone who lives in Charlotte or Atlanta or whatever who may have season tickets. They're not going to be able to come to all three of those games, I wouldn't think, or it'd be a challenge to get to all three. And so, and I think some of that is the bigger arenas. You have more tickets for people who live in those places to get. And there's more games now. And I mean, it's just all, and the days that you play. I mean, that Saturday, Monday, those are hard to get to both of them unless you live very close by, I would think.
Well, and as of today, as we're talking, you can buy tickets to that Virginia game on GoHeels.com, face value tickets. And so we might sit here and go, how is that possible? But then, I mean, that Virginia game by itself should be a huge game. It looks like that'll be a top 10 game. But you can't even think about that game yet because you got two other big games before then. So, I'd almost forgotten Carolina played Virginia that day. So how do you blame anyone else for not buying their tickets when it seems so far away, even though after Saturday it's going to be like, oh, that Virginia game's like an hour from now.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think the schedule is tricky.
Anything else on the list, Adam?
No.
That was had a lot going on that.
Yeah, wide-ranging list.
Okay, couple of quick things. We received a tweet from Ashley Creech, and part of her tweet was a link where she says it supports Adam's conspiracy theory about phones listening to you.
I saw that.
Now, first of all, it's not Adam. It's me who believes this. But Adam, we appreciate this. We frequently get these types of messages from folks of these type of stories that are being written.
Yep.
So I think you can agree that it's pretty clear that this happens now, right?
Yes.
Okay, and I'll give you another example of this. In the office a week or so ago, somebody was asking about somebody in the office is getting married. What up? And and they were asking about getting insurance for the engagement ring. They're like, how does the insurance for engagement rings work? Do you do it through your homeowners? Like, blah, blah, blah. They were asked this question. And I said, being the helpful coworker that I
sure,
am,
yeah.
I was like, you know.
And the old guy.
Right. Yeah. I was like, what? Yeah, sadly. I was like, what you can do is you get this personal article floater and you do all this and you can get it this way. That's how we did it and it worked out well. Like a day later, I have an email come to me from Chubb, which is an insurance company that does personal article floaters on things like engagement rings. Adam, I've never gotten one since or before. There's no reason for me to get that. There's no doubt that it's happening. No doubt.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'll even go so far as to say, and I guess this is just generally accepted. What?
But you can't turn the microphone off your phone.
Can you?
Well, but how are you going to talk to people then?
It'd be tough. Well, and you and Big Grits informed me of this FaceTime breach the other day.
I've turned off FaceTime.
The Russians were totally listening on my conversations.
I'm sure people are desperately wanting to know, like, to hack into my FaceTime so they can see what I'm doing all the time. Yeah. Where I'm, like, sitting at my desk like, like, wow, this is exciting.
Yeah, so make sure your FaceTime is up to date.
FaceTime's off. Hadn't come up with the patch yet, at least as of this time.
And y'all fixed mine. Which means you're going to have to change it back when that gets solved.
Eric, I can't FaceTime little baby. How do I fix this? quick little vacation from life, Adam. Not even like a full vacay from life, just a real quick.
Like
one.
A staycation from life?
Yeah, maybe that. Maybe like a long weekend from life.
Okay.
So after road games, the Tar Heels get food on the bus. Like, you get to order some food after games.
Yeah.
And so we travel, the basketball team nice enough to have us travel with them from the radio network. And so they're also nice enough to ask me if I'd like a sandwich or whatever, and they send me the menu.
What up to the Tar Heel managers who facilitate that? They do good work.
Drew Seagrove's head manager this year. And so I received the menu, and so I was going through it, and there was an item called turkey with a twist. And so normally I go for, like, the turkey sandwich. It's safe. It's easy to eat. You know, just everything that's pretty is pretty clear. So I said, I'm going, what is on this turkey with a twist, Adam?
That's gutsy.
You might ask. It is turkey, cheese, I think. That's not the twist. Lettuce, onion, mayo, which I don't love, but okay. Green apple slices, Granny Smith. Now I said, this doesn't sound necessarily like something I would always go for. Turkey with a twist, though. And something I have learned, I don't know if I learned it from going places with you, but probably, where you go to a restaurant and you go, look, it's the only time I'm going to be here.
Yeah.
What do I have to have? It's the only time I'm here. So I figured turkey with a twist, I've never seen it before. I'm going for it. Adam, I got to tell you something. It was delicious. The Granny Smith apples provided this little bit of kind of sour. And you know I don't like green apples that much, especially my Skittles. We know this. But real green apple, a little bit of crunchy, soury goodness in there. So try it out. That's all I'm saying. Just give it a shot one time. You may hate it, and if so, I apologize. But I'd give it a shot. Green apple slices on your turkey sandwich. Are you ready for a story time?
Yes.
Okay. We have a couple interesting story time options here. We have one story time, which is the one I am going to choose for today, which is from Daniel Grinder. Nice.
On that hashtag grind.
Yeah. There's another one that we received. Actually, we have multiple ones. We have one from Kyle Louder, which we're not going to do today. But we are going to do, and it's one of the most amazing. It has nothing to do with the Tar Heels, but it has everything to do with dropping your cell phone in water, which you may remember a member of my family, no names need to be discussed, dropped the cell phone into the toilet here recently. And so they had to get a new cell phone has been purchased. So on the heels of that, we received that story about the cell phone in the water. And it's a pretty incredible story. But we're not going to do that one today. We're going to do this from Daniel. And this is a good one. This is a good one, too. Nice little Tar Heel touch on this one. So, Adam, fire up Mr. Goosehunkers. Get him out of that box. Mr. Goosehunkers doesn't travel with us to the Mobile Pod World headquarters. We only bring him for occasions like this. Fire up Mr. Goosehunkers, because Daniel's story starts like this. I, Daniel Grinder, went to UNC from 2002 to 2006. From the time of my earliest sports-related memory, his parents letting him stay up to watch the second half of the 93 National Championship, and as Daniel learned a little bit ago, George Lynch just freewheeling on that play, go trap Chris Webber. Your heart's content. I knew that UNC was the only school I could see myself attend. A huge fan of the university and the basketball team, there were years in high school where every article of clothing I owned was Carolina blue. Daniel, this is a totally normal American child story so far. It was the only school I applied to, and I was incredibly excited to be coming in with the highly touted freshman class of Raymond Felton, Sean May, and my sophomore year, my girlfriend at the time lived in Carmichael dorm. Hey, what a sick brav that you had a girlfriend your sophomore year, Daniel. One floor below Sean May's then girlfriend, who lived on the top floor. I got the honor of oftentimes bumping into Sean in the dorm on a regular basis as they were dropping their girlfriends off after a nice evening for dinner.
At 8:30.
Yeah. I was pretty starstruck, so I never said a word to him. I was a pretty immature 19-year-old at the time, so I would do some pretty childish things. This is unfamiliar to me. I don't know what you're talking about on this one, Daniel. One day, on my way down from seeing my girlfriend, I hit every button in the elevator prior to the doors opening on the first floor. Whatever poor sap got on next would have to stop at every floor. When the doors opened to the lobby, I died of embarrassment when Sean May stepped in as I stepped out. Fast forward to the next year. Daniel moved to an apartment complex off MLK. By sheer coincidence, Sean May's still girlfriend moved into the apartment above me. Coincidence, Daniel. Yeah, I'm giving you the air quotes, champ. And Sean was a consistent presence at the apartment complex. Daniel was still ashamed of the elevator incident, and every time he left his apartment, he would look furtively out of his blinds to make sure Sean's car wasn't there so that he wouldn't see me and confront me with the fact I had made him stop on three additional floors one night in the winter of 2004. Daniel, thank you first for your honesty. And second, thank you for your story. Adam, I have to say, everybody's done some not smart things in their life. I can't say that I have ever hit all the buttons on. I've never done that. Can't say I've ever hit all the elevator buttons. I mean, I get it, but I've never done that one.
I never have done that before either, and also not when the Final Four MOP is getting ready to get in the elevator.
Yeah.
I think, obviously, as when we had Eric Hoots on to discuss unicycles, we'll need to have Sean and see if he recalls this. If he's been angry about it ever since, we'll give him Daniel's email address.
I've always wondered who that picture with a big X through his face in Sean's office. Who is that?
I thought it would be much more likely that he would have someone else. But
it's not Lee Melchione. Who is that?
That was, and in addition to thanking him for all those other things, we should thank him for his newfound maturity.
Yeah, that's right.
It's kind of a cautionary tale now.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, kids, don't hit all the elevator buttons. You never know who's walking on next. Adam, do you have anything else today, fine sir?
A lot has happened in this pod.
Yeah. Coming up later this week, I don't want to say this out loud with 100% certainty, but I think we're going to do our Roadhouse Challenge with Footloose.
I've already watched the movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I will. We will We have an interview series planned, a series of interviews, not a multiple series, here on part one of an 8-part series with. No, we have a series of interviews for Friday planned. Haven't done them yet, so don't want to tell you who it is just yet, just in case things go haywire. But we have a good set of interviews coming up. Wednesday is signing day for Tar Heel, the second signing day for the college football period, so we'll be able to more fully talk about Carolina's signing class in total for football. Of course, we'll be able to recap the state game and look ahead to Miami coming up in at the Smith Center this weekend. So all of that coming up later in the week. Plus, I think we'll probably have to give that cell phone story time too, just because it just defies the laws of physics, really. So we'll get to that too. But for now, we will let 1993 national champion George Lynch and Adam Dillon. We have a Big Grits. We have an Eric Montrose. Don't you think they both need to be involved here?
Yeah, teammates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to let both Eric and George Lynch, and of course the RZA, send you out on the latest edition of the Carolina Insider.
Hi, I'm George Lynch. See you later, Big Grits.
This is Big Grits to all you other grits saying, see you later, Big Grits.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat grits for dinner.
Pound box of sugar and a stick of margarine. A hot pot of grits kept my family from starving. Steamy hot meal served less than 5 minutes. Big silver pot boiling water salt in it. House full of brothers and sisters, the pot's missing. Pilgrim on a box on the stove in the kitchen.
When I was small, we had nothing at all. We used to eat.
See you later, Big Grit.
The preceding has been a Learfield presentation.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.